tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I am your host, Stacey LeBaron, and I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 30 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. Today, we're speaking with Michael Schneider. Michael started Pilots to the Rescue back in 2015 to combine his love of aviation and saving animals. Michael is a commercial instrument-rated pilot with more than 1,200 hours. When Michael isn't flying, he enjoys spending time with his wife, four boys under 8 years of age, and his 80-pound rescue dog. Michael currently resides in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and flies out of Essex County Airport in Caldwell, New Jersey. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. And by the way, my rescue pup is now 100 pounds. She put on a couple.
Just a couple.
Yeah, big dog.
Wow. Bigger than your kids.
Bigger than my kids. But she doesn't take crap from my oldest, my 8-year-old boy anymore. It's interesting to see how she treats each individual boy based on her age. Like the youngest, who's 3, could do anything he wants to her. 8-year-old, she starts growling at him.
Oh, wow.
Animals are so intuitive. They're more intelligent than we give them credit for.
Yeah. So people are going to be asking, well, Stacey, why are you having like a pilot on the show? What do pilots have to do with community cats? So first off, I'm going to ask you, what's your experience with community cats, cats in general? Why are you passionate about helping cats and animals in general?
I am passionate about cats because I grew up with rescue cats. I remember having a rescue cat for most of my young adult life, including all the way up through college. I think we've had more rescue cats than dogs, and I've always had an affinity towards rescue animals, and cats play a very special place in my heart. And we love transporting cats just because they need our help, and we could fit way more in the plane than a dog. And you think about cats in general, they're easier to have in the city. Being in Brooklyn, it's so much easier to have a cat. Most landlords are not nearly as concerned about rescue cats or cats in general versus dogs. They're less of a nuisance. So, you know, I'm very passionate about rescuing cats. They need our help probably more than dogs. From what I understand, they're harder to euthanize too, which breaks my heart. And that's, you know, I love them. I love cats. I wish I could have cats. I think my dog wouldn't do well with a cat. My wife's not a fan, but hopefully we can have some cats in our future.
Well, so tell me a little bit about Pilots to the Rescue. You started it in 2015, so I guess go back, and I don't know whether it's a year or more than that. Like, tell me your why. Why did you start this?
So I started Pilots to Rescue because almost any recreational pilot will tell you, after flying somewhere for a meal, taking someone on a tour, you're looking for ways to give back or to exercise your pilot privileges. And for me, I heard of some organizations transporting people who are in need of medical treatment and animals that need to get to point A to B to have a better chance of being adopted. And because I always loved working or, you know, having rescue animals, and I knew that they needed our help, I started doing some missions with a like organization. And then I realized most of the aircraft that we have available to us to rent are just too small. So I, being a serial entrepreneur and knowing that I could start my own organization, really was selfishly was because I wanted to fly a bigger, more powerful plane that I could rent. But that selfish notion turned into be the best thing for rescue animals. And now we've rescued over 3,000 animals. And, you know, I've got to combine my loves.
Tell me about your first flight with animals. Was it nerve-wracking? Was it a nightmare? Was it a success? Did the dogs throw up all over the place? What happened?
Yeah, the first rescue we did was to rescue a litter of ditch puppies from North Carolina. A lot of people, unfortunately, like to witness the miracle of birth, have a litter of puppies. They try to sell them. They realize nobody will buy them. They can't bring them to the local shelter because they're already full, and they literally threw them in a ditch in the side of the road. You hear these heartbreaking stories of people dumping them in dumpsters behind Pepco or whatnot. So there was a group in Connecticut that was willing to take these puppies. And of course, puppies and kittens, they have very high adoption rates versus the adult, more adult or senior animals. So we picked up the call of duty and flew down to North Carolina and transported them to Connecticut. It was a different feeling than I was used to flying. I mean, flying in itself, as you can imagine, is thrilling. And there's a big endorphin and adrenaline rush. But this time it felt as if I was truly giving back and making a difference in not only in the animals' lives, but the people that adopted them. We don't always hear about the stories after they adopt them, but in this case we did. And that had a lasting effect. It was more than just that single flight that we did. And we often find out the animals that we rescue end up rescuing the people that adopt them. So that is a great feeling of fulfillment. And it's something that I challenge a lot of people with, including the listeners to your podcast, is it's very easy to write a check and donate to your favorite cause. I mean, we all need money. It's never enough. It's harder to roll up your sleeves, go to your local shelter and actually get involved physically. But I will tell you that the benefits are tenfold and they come back to you tenfold. And things will start happening in your life that you can't really explain. And that's really the true meaning of life is giving back. And it's way more powerful than receiving. So you asked me how it feels to do something like that. Well, now it's just like a high and I can't get enough of it.
How many animals, cats or dogs, can you fit on one transport?
So our current plane is a 6-passenger plane and it's similar to like a compact SUV. We can take the 4 rear seats out. And we've done, I think our record cats was 52. Dogs, we can do mixed sizes, about 10. With dogs, it's always the crates that limit the ability to transport. Cats, it's a lot easier because they simply take up less room. So that's why we love transporting cats. We are raising money to purchase a larger, more capable, reliable, safer aircraft. And we can do 2 to 3 times the amount. So if you can imagine, we would be able to do, let's say, 150 cats. I can only imagine the sounds that will be coming from the back of that aircraft when we do 150 cats.
I'm going to ask you the question that most people ask who are not very familiar with transport, which is of cats. You know, it's very stressful for cats, or is it very stressful for cats? How does it feel to you coming from the pilot's perspective?
The transporting of the animals, the loading of the animals is definitely the most stressful for the animal and the riskiest part because they most likely have never been on a plane before, and they're going into a new environment, and you know that's when you could get bitten or scratched. Generally, with the cats, we just leave them in the crates that they are traveling in. We don't transport them into our crates, whereas the dogs, we use these special crates, and we're often, you know, putting them in those crates, transferring. But with the cats, it's less liability, less risk. And then once we start up that engine, the vibrations and the noise tends to make them settle down. And then as we fly, it's unpressurized, the cabin. It's not like the commercial planes that you take. So when you fly and we start climbing in altitude, they tend to get a little sleepy because there's less oxygen. We don't go above 8,000 feet. That's what commercial planes are pressurized at, 8,000 feet, simply because of the fact that they can become hypoxic. Well, the lack of oxygen, it can be dangerous. And I've witnessed this personally when I had someone, a human being in the back of the cabin with a bunch of dogs. We took an altitude of 9,000 from air traffic control. And the person in the back said it looked like the dog was having trouble breathing. So it is a real thing. With humans, generally, those hypoxic feelings come around like 12, 13,000 feet. And with the animals, the ceiling is 8,000. But they just go to sleep. They mostly go to sleep.
Interesting. And this organization, Pilots to the Rescue, are you a nonprofit or for-profit?
We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we survive on donations. We've had some very generous people, and we're extremely loyal to them. I run the organization like my previous businesses, which is a really important thing to point out because a lot of charities that we work with in the animal welfare world, and Stacey, I know you will relate to this, they have bleeding hearts. So they'll do everything and anything they can to save an animal. But what you have to realize sometimes, not every animal is worth saving because it is so expensive when you start getting into the surgeries and all that stuff. And we want to save as many as possible. But the point I'm trying to make is I run this like a business and we make decisions based that make sense financially. And then you start talking about aviation and the costs, they're similar to like operating on animals. They're just silly. They're astronomical. So We do a lot of ground transport. That's what people don't realize. And ground transport is how most of these rescues are happening. And it's very necessary because financially, it's more viable. But the planes are what gets the attention. It's sexy. It's a novel concept. So we lead with that. It is Pilots to Rescue, and we have some amazing volunteers. But behind the scenes, we're doing a ton of ground transport. And it's a big relief to our organization when the planes go down. And it's a big relief to those amazing road warriors, all those people doing ground transport with the other shelters that drive through the night to meet us so we don't have to fly to Texas, for example. And we save the time in the engine or on the plane. And we also are helping out these shelters, these amazing road warriors that, you know, they need a break once in a while. So that's what a lot of people don't realize about our organization. And we're acquiring more ground transport vehicles so we can be that full circle solution for these shelters that maybe they don't have as many resources.
Interesting. Very interesting. We didn't mention it earlier. So, you're transporting animals, but there are also times where your cabin is empty if you're going to a location. And so if there's a wholesaler or manufacturer of food or supplies or something like that, that's also something that you're willing to consider taking to a place that's in great need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's almost heartbreaking to fly down to these places down south empty. So we are always welcome to take unused donations of foods, toys, blankets, towels, stuff like that. And it's very rewarding because these shelters, these municipally run shelters in the South, they have lack of space, but they also have a limited budget. One of the things that we started doing also is helping out new adopters we have these adoption kits with some vital supplies, whether it be leashes or treats or dog beds or cat scratchers and stuff like that. So that's one of the roadblocks in adopting animals, the sheer cost. You have adoption fees, of course, but you have medical, you have food costs, and it's not nothing. I mean, it costs money to have one of these pets. So if we can play a small part in transporting these supplies down south before we pick up the animals, it's well worth it. And when we get that larger plane, we're going to be doing more disaster response. So we can bring in a ton of supplies because a lot of these supplies, they either get destroyed or they need so many supplies because of the disaster that came through. Even supplies for humans and the volunteers that work for the shelters, whether it be bottled water or food and stuff like that. The airports are some of the first to open up in disasters, and the roads are often impassable. So it's important.
Yeah. I also wanted to touch base with regards to transportation of animals from one state to another requires certain paperwork. Is that something you're involved with, or is that one organization, like the sending organization versus receiving, and you're just getting the file and taking it along or sending it along digitally? What's your role in this process?
We focus on the transport, so we do leave that responsibility to the origin and destination shelters, and they are very familiar with the state requirements. And it comes more into play, you know, with the recipient state. I know Massachusetts, for example, is very stringent requirements. A lot of those transports the destination ends up being Connecticut or New Hampshire for that reason. But yeah, we generally focus on the transport, and we're always taking paperwork and medications to their final destination. So a lot of these shelters, the recipient shelters that we work with, have existing relationships with sourcing that they've worked with for many years. And from time to time, they entertain new relationships, but they have their requirements. Us as an organization and doing transport, we focus on this, cleaning practices and procedures is so important. We don't want to lose an animal on our watch. So luckily we've never had one animal perish in our care. I can't say the same for after, because there's some communicable diseases that happen and you don't know where along that process it's happened. Some of them are highly contagious, but at least we can do our part in making sure that the cabin of the aircraft and the crates are cleaned with vet-approved solutions and stuff like that. So that's where we focus our effort and energy.
Wonderful. Yeah, and it's, I just think that there are so many moving parts. Right now, we have these teams of veterinarians and technicians going all around the country with tons of supplies and traps and equipment to do massive spay-neuter events. And so I could foresee a lot of transport. You're helping moving some of those supplies and maybe even some of those veterinarians that aren't being fully utilized in one part of the country to another part to be able to do a 400 or 500 cat spay neuter event or something like that. Because we have to all start being extremely strategic about how impactful our efforts are. And we have these tools to us. And yes, you maybe moving animals around, but there may be other resources. I was just thinking of a situation. We have tomahawk live traps. They're located in Wisconsin. And if there's an emergency situation and you need to get a lot of box traps delivered, maybe that's another scenario to get them to an area where you're doing a massive trapping program and you need to get, and they can't ship them all. So you have to go pick them up and you bring them into an area where there's a massive, you know, whether it's a fire or something else, and you have to go in and do some massive trapping. So it sounds like emergency response is one of the top items sort of in your bucket list of items looking forward for the organization.
Absolutely. There's about a dozen of these aviation rescue groups and animal welfare in the United States. But one of the things we pride ourselves on is the content that we derive and the storytelling, which is so important because we're still euthanizing nearly a million animals in this country. And we have a great vehicle to get that story out there. We're only scratching the surface in sheer volume of numbers, animals that we can rescue, but we're able to get our story out there. And if it's striking while the iron's hot in a natural disaster, and that's where the news is going, we need to play our part. And it's going to trend well. And it might sound opportunistic, but we're helping out those areas that are under tremendous stress at that time. And that's a great use case for aviation.
If you want to catalog all your cat sightings to manage your colonies easier, then Whisker Tracker is for you. It's a free mobile app that lets you create cat profiles, see your cats on a map, and track the health and status of all your cats. Download the Whisker Tracker mobile app today. Are you getting your message across to your entire community? Do they know what programs you offer and what they can do to help? Learn more about how to effectively market your organization or just sharpen your skills with a free self-paced marketing course, The Fundamentals of Marketing on Maddie's University. The course is designed to provide a basic understanding of marketing and provide you with templates and tools to elevate and improve your organization's brand, voice, and audience, and have fun while doing it. You'll receive a strategic marketing plan template to download free. Go to university.maddiesfund.org and search marketing to enroll now.
You had touched upon something that we actually looked into doing because we have a rescue pilot who works with us who's also a veterinarian. So she's offered her services multiple times to jump on board free of charge, bring supplies, and do mass vaccinations. Obviously, she can't do spaying and neutering because that requires a certain setup, but vaccinations are expensive and it requires a technician to do it. And she's certainly competent at that. So that we're going to take her up on an offer. And that makes it even more rewarding to alleviate animals from a overcrowded area, but also vaccinating the local ones that may maybe have, you know, are going to be adopted. So you're absolutely right. You got to think about the best use case of this aviation resources because it's extremely expensive as an organization. And like I said earlier, ground transport is always going to be the more economical, more viable option.
Right. But you were also saying you are a recreational pilot. And if you're going there anyway, is there a way to make it purposeful versus, you know, flying for lunch at the diner around the corner, right?
Right. We have a transport board on our website at pilotstherescue.org, and it is a do-it-yourself system. It is getting more popular. And the intention is that if you have a small load, because typically we take a full load in the aircraft and it's out of New Jersey, so it doesn't make sense to fly to Utah. But if you have a small load, it could be one, two, three animals, whatever, you post it on the website. They have to be at risk, so we're not transporting people's pets. But then we have a database of over 1,000 pilots and drivers. They'll get a notification and they can pick up the legs themselves and communicate with whoever's trying to transport that animal. We do have some success with that program and we're hoping that will grow. Me personally, 99% of the flying I do is for the charity and it's for rescues. I can't remember the last time I took a recreational flight. Unfortunately, I missed doing that. But once we get the larger plane, I have a family of six. So yeah, absolutely. If we need to go somewhere and we have the opportunity to bring back some rescue animals, I'll take advantage of that. There's some considerations there with weather and maintenance of the plane and all that. But, you know, love to do that if possible.
Oh, my father is a former pilot. I mean, he's now 91. So I grew up in the day where you had the airplanes and you're flying and you look over and you'd say, was that 95 down there? Well, it used to be 128 in Boston. But, you know, I was like, honey, what does it look like down there? That kind of thing. So back in the Skymaster, I think, was the plane that he had back in the day. So we have huge aviation fans in my family, for sure. I just, on a side question, I'm going to ask you a side note, because there has been the creation of an airline that is for dog owners, and they can buy a seat on the plane with them and their dog, and they can fly commercially. I want to say, I think it's like from New York to LA and various other places. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, you're talking about Bark Air. Yes, much needed service. People were doing this even before Bark Air. Some people have tried and have failed. Then there's also groups that organize charters where they charter aircraft and they sell seats on it, more not so much as a profit like Bark Air, but as a way to travel with their pet. The airlines, commercial airlines, have made it increasingly difficult to travel with your pet. Cats, obviously, is a lot easier because they fit underneath the seat in front of you. But if you own a dog, a larger dog, it's almost dangerous or a liability to the airline. So they're interested in moving people, not pets. But to answer your question, I think Bark Air is smart. I think it's smart not just to satisfy a need, also as a way extension of the brand to try to get more people interested in what BarkBox does. I think it's fairly reasonable for what they're doing. Certainly a better option than chartering aircraft, which is very expensive. And we get a ton of requests for people wanting to travel with their pets, and it's not something we can do legally. There are FAA rules about what we can and can't do. And we can't sell seats on an aircraft or transport animals for hire. So we're often telling people the cheapest way to travel with your pet is going to be to drive. And if they don't have the capability of doing that, there are lots of reputable people. There's Citizen Shipper, if you're familiar with that. You basically put out a request for proposal, and there's drivers. It's sort of like the Uber for pets, but there's ratings and stuff like that. That's always going to be the least expensive. But if you personally need to go somewhere and you're willing to spend the money and you feel most comfortable traveling your pet, Bark Air is great. And they're expanding. I know they have routes, New York, LA, Chicago, London, Paris. But for the general public, it's still too expensive. I mean, $6,000, one way to go from like New York to LA.
Well,
yeah. But take it as an opportunity to take a cross-country trip with your vehicle. Or pay someone to transport.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question as being the leader of a nonprofit organization, relatively new. It's 9 years, so it's been a while, but not super long. What have been your challenges that you've discovered over the course of running a nonprofit? It sounds like you've been involved in businesses previously to that. So there's business and then there's nonprofit business. And are they different to you? I mean, you're running it like a business, but it sounds like maybe you've discovered that nonprofit business philosophy may have approached you in a very different way.
Well, yes. So the surprises of running a charity organization is the lack of compensation, or compensation rules, I should say. In the for-profit world, if I was running, last year was our best year, and it's all public knowledge. Last year was our best year. We brought in $3.2 million. If it was a for-profit, I would be paying myself probably, you know, over $500,000, and nobody would think any different than that. But that would be considered excessive. I live in Brooklyn. I have 4 kids. And, you know, so I had to get used to paying myself less and living on less, which is fine. It certainly made up with the plus side of that is all the accolades and encouragement I get from people. Like when I would make a sale in a for-profit business, the satisfaction you get is short-lived. So the compensation might be here, but the satisfaction's here. Compensation, and people can't see me, but I have a compensation. My hands are high in the air for compensation and low in satisfaction. That has switched. So in the nonprofit world, the compensation is low, but satisfaction is much higher. And as I get a little bit older and wiser, I realize it's not about the money. It's not about buying the latest car or a new pair of sneakers. It's really about feeling a sense that you're able to make this world a better place and feeling that you're useful. And that you're able to help people and help animals. And it comes with a different type of compensation. So that's one thing I had to get used to. The other thing I would say is I don't have any formal training running a charity. I'm not so sure there is any formal training. I mean, I know they have these programs where you can become like a nonprofit professional. And when I brought this up with a group that I had no formal training, and they're like, we don't have any formal training. Like it's a lot of learning as you go. Then I would say, the aviation side is the most challenging, like keeping the planes up in the air. That has become the most challenging in our organization. And how to remain relevant in the space, because the planes don't, they're not always reliable. So what do we do? Well, that's where that ground transport piece came in. And the last thing I would say, if this was a for-profit business, I would have way more people working for me. But I've noticed with a lot of charities my size, they end up running into problems. They run out of money because they hire too many people. And many of these people are underpaid. They're overworked and underpaid. So I'm the overworked and underpaid person, but I'm an only employee, so it's okay. But that's really why funds are available and we've done so well, is because I haven't saddled the organization with a lot of debt and overhead. I find that's worked well for me. At a certain point, I won't be able to do that. But for right now, we're kind of that not tiny charity, a little bit more mature, but not this huge charity with a lot of overhead.
And how much of that is revenue, program revenue versus fundraising?
That's a good question. I should know that off the top of my head. We go through a volunteer audit every year. I don't know those. I don't know the answer of that right off the top of my head. I'd have to look at the 990 to figure that out.
So I'd assume you have fees. You charge fees for service.
No, we don't charge fees for service.
No charge for fees for service.
We can charge because the FAA, we're a Part 91 organization. That's a designation by the FAA. We're not allowed to charge to transport animals, period.
So from the sending organization, the receiving organization, no funds are received to you.
That's right.
So everything is fundraised.
Correct.
What were your best fundraising avenues to grow the organization to the level that you're at right now?
Direct mail is more than a third of the funds raised. And then after that, I would say family foundations and individual donors, family foundation, individual donors, and third, a distant third, which might surprise some people, especially younger people, is online and social media. I remember we worked with Guiding Eyes for the Blind, and they're like a $30 million charity. And I had the pleasure of flying with the CEO, Thomas Panic, and he told me, don't put a lot of time and effort into online fundraising because it pales in comparison with offline donations. And simple fact is our demographic of donor is 65 plus female. And they're not necessarily on Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, not everybody feels comfortable donating online. So,
well, this has been an incredible little bit of a nonprofit masterclass here. So even if folks are not considering putting cats in your planes, they certainly can take advantage of this nonprofit strategy session, because I do find we get very distracted. You're not saying you're going off and doing some mega multi-million dollar banquet or a big fancy event that has big costs to it. You say direct mail and you say relationships with leadership donors and family foundations, which I kind of group in the same category, and then online social media right after that. So I think that's a fantastic strategy. If folks are interested in finding out more about Pilots to the Rescue, how would they do that?
If folks are interested in finding more about Pilots to the Rescue, you can go to pilotstotherescue.org. It's all spelled out, pilots with an S. Or social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn, we're all over the place. We always need donations, but there's also an opportunity for people to sign up as a driver if you want to help with ground transport. And obviously, you can go to our mission list. We list all our partners that we work with. You can offer up help. These animals need your love. They need to be walked. They need to be petted. So going to your local shelter is a great way to give back.
Any other last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just the challenge to give back, to roll up your sleeves, actually get physically involved in some shape or form. We love donations, but it is 10 times more rewarding to physically give back, whether it's with your children's school or going to your local shelter. Just take it upon yourself to donate your time physically and watch what happens in your life.
Excellent. Michael, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on the show, and I hope we'll have you on again in the future.
Please. Thanks for having me, Stacey.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.